This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Dr. Dale Archer. He's psychiatric medical director at Lake Charles Memorial Hospital. His new book is called The ADHD Advantage. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great to be here.
So the diagnosis of ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is relatively recent, like maybe 35 years old or so. And you make the case in your book that it shouldn't or should rarely be a medical diagnosis. Tell us about your journey, both as a doctor and as a patient, to this conclusion.
The diagnosis didn't appear in the psychiatric manual, the DSM, until 1980. And so we basically are looking at a relatively new condition in terms, at least, of the diagnostic criteria. And it's interesting that it went from, of course, zero in 1980 because it didn't exist then, up until recently, where the latest poll shows that it's 11% of American school-age kids between the ages of 5 and 17 have the diagnosis, about 5% of adults. So that's a staggering increase. And, of course, along the way, as more and more people have been diagnosed, unfortunately, the knee-jerk reaction and treatment for this condition has been a pill. So my point in the book is that ADHD doesn't occur like an on-off switch. So you look at the manual and you've got 9 symptoms. If you have 6 of those 9, you get a diagnosis. If you have 5 of 9, you don't. Rather, it should occur along a continuum with symptoms ranging from 1, which is virtually very, very minor or non-existent, all the way up to 10 or 10 plus. When you're in that 10 to 10 plus range, then I would say yes, it is a diagnosis. It's probably going to need some type of treatment, maybe even medication in the most severe cases. Unfortunately, today what we're doing is we're carrying the diagnosis, so we're diagnosing folks who are in the 4, the 5, and the 6 range. We're diagnosing them, and that diagnostic nomenclature carries the exact same treatment recommendations for somebody who's a 10 or a 10 plus. So we're medicating people with very, very mild symptoms. We're not talking about what else goes along with this ADHD diagnosis, what are some of the advantages, and then we're over-medicating way, way too many people.
What I really liked about the book was that the symptoms or this classification of ADHD as a pathology, as a diagnosis, can be reframed as a personality. And as a personality, these people who have these symptoms, they may not be well adapted to things like school where you have to sit still for a long period of time or 9-to-5 office work where you're sitting in front of a computer all day, but they're very, very well adapted to other things. So you have to wonder whether it's something that should be pathologized or whether maybe the society is the problem itself.
There's no doubt that society is part of the problem. I mean, you can look at the reasons that go into this epidemic, and it's an epidemic of our own making. But it's a pop-a-pill culture. It's parents that are stressed out, overworked teachers, big pharma making $9 billion a year in terms of selling stimulant medication, pop-a-pill psychiatry, where psychiatrists really don't get a lot of therapy training anymore. It's all about the medication. So all of those things go into the overdiagnosis and over-medication of ADHD. And I think, to your point, that when we talk about personality type, there's a fine line between quirky, different, little bit quote-unquote not normal versus pathology, psychiatric diagnosis, and medication. And 30 years ago, we had a big box called normal that a lot of people fit into. People that were different had idiosyncrasies and quirks, but that was fine. There was room for all of us. But as we've gone on over the last 35 years, we've shrunk this normal box down smaller and smaller and smaller, and now we're pathologizing symptoms that are part of everyday life, And psychiatry has become the de facto profession, which is defining what's normal and what's not. And if you fall outside of the range of the quote-unquote normal box, well, then you take a pill in order to get you back into being normal. And, of course, normal means average, means just like everyone else.
Which is kind of Orwellian in a lot of ways. I mean, I hadn't really thought about it that much, but 3 out of the 4 words in this diagnosis are negative. I mean, attention, that's neutral. Deficit, that's negative. Hyperactivity is negative. Disorder. Let's start with attention deficit. A lot of people with this personality, they may really not have attention for things that they find boring, like rote learning or whatever, but they have a lot of attention for things that they find interesting.
And that's the key to the ADHD brain. You know, in the book, of course, I go through many, many advantages of the ADHD continuum. We all know that there are disadvantages that go along with it at the high end of the continuum. No one's talking about the advantages. And I think that attention span and focus and concentration on things that you find boring is very, very fascinating, because the ADHD brain is easily bored with routine. So we find the routine tasks, sitting in a classroom for 8 hours a day, which I think everyone finds boring, but to the ADHD brain, it's horrific. In those cases, it's extremely hard for us to focus and concentrate. But if we find something that we find fascinating, then we can hyper-focus. And I interview many, many people in the book who talk about finally finding their calling, finding what they were fascinated with. I think David Neeleman, the founder of JetBlue, is probably the great example, where he could barely make it through school. He couldn't focus for more than 5 minutes at a time. And then he gets out and he falls in love with airplanes and the airline industry, and all he wants to do is learn about it and study, and he focuses on it, and he comes up with a whole new idea and founds JetBlue with this new way of doing things in the airline industry. And I'm talking to him about during our interview, and he goes, how can a brain like mine, a brain who barely made it through school, a brain who couldn't sit still, focus, or concentrate on anything for more than 5 minutes at a time, how could that brain be a brain that found a whole new way of doing things and founding an airline that was completely different than anything else that was out there? And hyperfocus is the key. And I could give a long neurochemical explanation in the brain, because we do have some theories on it, but at the end result, hyperfocus is a tremendous strength of the ADHD brain when you find something that you are fascinated in.
The H in ADHD is hyperactivity, which was actually added to the diagnosis more recently than the original diagnosis, which was ADD. And my sense is that, like, just the word hyperactivity kind of assumes a norm for activity, that anything over that is excessive. And, like, that makes sense for things like blood sugar or body temperature, which are tightly regulated values for real reasons. They need to stay within certain limits for health. But activity seems like not only a highly variable individual trait, but maybe even a good thing. Like, and it becomes a bad thing only when you have environments that try to limit your activity. And in a world where gym classes are being cut out and sitting still is really rewarded, again, you wonder whether the diagnosis of hyperactivity might have more to do with society than with an individual person's strength or weakness.
Well, of course, there's two ways, once again, a positive and a negative way to define hyperactivity. Hyperactivity sounds bad. That's a negative. High energy, on the other hand, sounds great. Who doesn't want to have high energy? So really, and they're the exact same thing. And we define the hyperactivity strictly and typically within the classroom setting, because these kids have a hard time sitting still in class. In the adult, it would be someone who has a hard time sitting at a desk for 8 hours a day doing routine paperwork. And so if you look at it in context and say, well, let's take that person and say that if they're a doctor, instead of being an internist seeing 25 routine patients a day, they're an ER doctor, so they're constantly up and about and dealing with crises and emergencies. Well, then you can understand how in one setting the hyperactivity is bad, but in another setting, the high energy is extremely helpful and effective.
We're talking to Dr. Dale Archer about his book, The ADHD Advantage. And given that ADHD is at least in part genetic. There's arguably an evolutionary advantage to it, and you've been talking about this to some extent, but like looking back at our, let's say, hunter-gatherer ancestors, what would be some advantages of this personality type?
When we talk about the evolutionary advantages, then we have to go back to a study back about 15 years ago at UC Irvine, which looked at the dopamine transporter and dopamine receptor genes. These are genes that are linked to ADHD. So in other words, when an individual has these genes, they have a much higher likelihood than not of having ADHD. And they wanted to see what was the spread around the world of this particular gene. And what they found was it was in the far reaches of the planet, Tierra del Fuego, Siberia, Alaska, Australia. It was basically those who had become bored with the routine village life and set out to wander the world. And they went as far as they could go, and then they couldn't go anymore. And down in Tierra del Fuego, in that southern tip of South America area, it was found in well over 60% of the population, staggering amount. And so the scientists coined the name Explorer Gene for this dopamine transporter gene. And I think that really sums up what ADHD is all about. It was those that in times of difficulty, in times of strife, when there was a crisis at hand, then they weren't bored and they could be at their best. Those are the adventurers and the entrepreneurs that we need today more than ever.
As I was reading your book, I was thinking about the work of a friend of mine who is a specialist in metaphors, and she was talking about the difference between hunter-gatherer personalities and farming and agricultural personalities. And you quoted someone in your book who was saying the same thing, like ADHD people are more like hunters than like farmers. But I think it's so interesting that in our school system, we have so many agricultural metaphors, like cultivating young minds and planting the seeds of learning and a new crop of graduates, and you're sitting in rows and you have to be patient and wait for things to ripen. And the kids who have that kind of 360-degree attention and want to run around outdoors and are looking out the windows and are really observant of nature, they're not rewarded, even though they are the hunter part of our human ancestry.
There was actually a colleague who pointed out that the ADHDers among us were hunters in a farming world. And so we're trying to turn the whole world and make it homogenous throughout, when the human brain doesn't work that way. And luckily, there's some really cutting-edge schools. Beacon Hill in Boston jumps to mind, Fusion Academy, which is around the U.S., where they refuse to call ADHD a disorder. They call it a learning difference as opposed to a disorder. And our brains do work differently, and we do learn differently. We're more hands-on. We do need more activity. You made the point about PE being cut. Not only is PE being cut in many public schools, recesses are being cut. Lunch hours are being shrunk. For the ADHDer, that's what we need the most. And if I had to give parents and adults one thing that helps the ADHD brain focus more than anything else, it's exercise. It's been proven time and time again. And these cutting-edge schools that I mentioned, they have exercise as an integral part of their classes, to the point where if a student is feeling restless, he's allowed to go outside and walk around the inner hallway one lap and then come back in. They have exercise, an integral part of the school program. In between classes, they get up and they walk a long distance around the hall before they go to their next class. They do very, very short subject lessons of 15 minutes or so, and then they move on to something else to keep that brain from being bored. They allow the kids to stand up at their desk. They don't have to just stay seated. So there are a whole host of things that work better for this brain. Unfortunately, it's not trickling down to the public school system, but we are starting to see it at least in the private school system.
Now, there seems to be some significant gender difference between males and females where this personality condition diagnosis is concerned. What are some of those differences?
Yeah, there's a huge difference in terms of numbers. So, you know, depending on the study, you're looking at anywhere from 5 to 7 times more common in boys than girls. And I think that part of that is the fact that we're just now starting to recognize, hey, this occurs in girls too, and why aren't we looking at it? So the studies are starting, and we'll probably have some data over the next 2 to 3 years that will help help focus the spotlight on girls more, because the one thing that girls don't have as much as the boys is the hyperactivity, and we're not really sure why. But the hyperactivity is what brings the individual to the attention of the authorities. And once the spotlight is focused on you, you're acting out, you're a bad kid, you've got problems, we need to fix that. Well, then they get sent to the school counselor, and the counselor refers them to a doctor, and the next thing you know, they're on medication. So the good thing for girls is that, okay, you're not being overdiagnosed as badly as boys are. The bad thing, maybe we're missing some along the way. And many girls that I interviewed for the book, and of course they're women now, said that, yeah, they had anxiety, they had depression, they had these other symptoms as they were going through school. They didn't have the hyperactivity. They didn't get the ADHD diagnosis. It wasn't until they got later in life and went and saw a specialist that they said, wow, that's what I've been dealing with, is ADHD. And I just wish I had known then, instead of waiting until I was 30 or 40 or 50 years old before finally finding out this is how my brain works.
So that happened to you yourself, and that happens to a lot of people. How does having a diagnosis, especially, you know, if you don't want to go the pill, the medication route, how does having that diagnosis help you and help others?
Well, I think the problem is the diagnosis today carries such a negative connotation. I'm not sure the diagnosis itself helps anybody, except those severe cases who absolutely need to be treated. So I wish we could refocus it in terms of you have a brain difference and this is what it is. But the way it helped me, and I think the way it helps a lot of people, and people that have, especially when they're adults, and so they've already learned how their brain works, they've learned what works best for them, they perhaps found their passion, their calling, and they're able to do very well, but they've always known that they don't think the way other people do, they don't learn the way other people do. And so it's a tremendous relief. For me, I didn't receive a formal diagnosis until I was in my early 50s. When I was researching my last book, there was a chapter on ADHD in it. And, of course, I diagnosed hundreds of ADHD kids. I'd raised an ADHD son. And I'm putting together a quiz in order to determine where you fell on the ADHD continuum. And, of course, as we were doing research with a colleague, the colleague looked at me and he goes, well, you know that you would be off the charts on the quiz. And so I took the quiz and he was right. And so then I went and saw another colleague who gave me a formal diagnosis. But it just confirms the fact that, aha, that's why I'm different. That's why I ended up choosing the path I chose. That's why I can hyper-focus on things I love. And if I'm bored with it, forget it. I can't even give you 10 minutes of my attention. And I just think that if we can get kids today and parents today to understand that difference and not try to force that round peg into a square hole, then we can take these kids and build to their strengths, teach them, yes, you have ADHD, yes, this is a condition, you're going to have difficulty with routine, but you're going to be great in a crisis, you're going to be a great multitasker, you're going to have high energy, and talk about the strengths, then we do away with that negative stereotype. And most importantly, we help them learn and jumpstart the process of how their brain is going to function and what is going to make it work the best for them.
I think it's interesting that a lot of ADHD people end up kind of being late bloomers. They find what they want to do maybe later than their friends and colleagues because they're kind of bouncing around trying a lot of things, but then it all comes together.
I think there are two parts to that. First of all, I tell ADHDers and I tell parents and I tell the kids that, look, if you can survive your early education, you're probably going to do okay because that's when it's the most challenging, that strict, rigid structure of early childhood education is terrifically hard for the ADHD brain. So not without a doubt, you constantly hear when these kids get to college that they often do bloom. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. Number one is they can do it their own way. My son is a classic example. C student all the way through high school, from grade school really all the way through, conduct problems, difficulty doing his homework, difficulty performing on the test, easily scattered, poor focus, poor concentration. He gets to college. All of a sudden, he's taking subjects he likes or loves. The classes are spread out, so you have to walk in between them, and you have time in between the classes. And then most importantly, you can do it your way. You can study your way. His way of studying was to do three things at once, being working on a history project while writing an English paper, perhaps studying some math homework while watching a sporting event on TV, and all of a sudden he was a straight-A student, literally from high school to college. He went to a very, very difficult college. So it was that ability to do it his way, plus the structure of college, that plays to the ADHDer's strengths. The same when they get into the business world. You know, ADHDers are three times more likely to form their own business than not. That's because we can do it our own way. And the rigid structure of a corporate environment is probably not the best for our brain, because a lot of times my best work is done at 5 o'clock in the morning. I'm an early riser, and that's when I'm at my best. Well, that doesn't play to a 9-to-5 office job. It doesn't matter if you do good work at 5. You've got to be there at 9, and you got to work till 5. So there's a whole host of reasons for that, but I think you're correct. I think that many of us are late bloomers, and for many of us, we have to try those multiple different things, those multiple jobs, to find our true love, to allow that hyper-focus to kick in to be successful.
We're talking to Dr. Dale Archer about his book, The ADHD Advantage. Now, how would you characterize a severe case that does need medication?
Well, when we're talking severe, we're talking 10 plus on the continuum. So basically, I did a research project with a colleague of mine, and we got hundreds of normals and ADHDers, and we had them fill out these questionnaires, and we found a continuum of these symptoms on a scale of 1 to 10. So if you're at a 10, you're severe. And in fact, some of them were so severe that we even had a 10-plus category because they were beyond the realm of severe. I don't recommend knee-jerk reaction even for the severe cases of medication. I do recommend that you need to have a diagnosis by an expert. And it's a little known fact that the majority of ADHD meds are prescribed by non-psychiatrists today. They're prescribed by pediatricians, family practitioners, OBGYNs, the primary care doctor of the individual, not by psychiatrists. So first recommendation, get a diagnosis by an expert in ADHD. If it's a child, then a child psychiatrist or child psychologist. If you're an adult, an ADHD specialist psychiatrist. Make sure that you're dealing with a true ADHD diagnosis. Next, look at non-medication treatments. And there are a couple that are very, very important. The therapies, from individual therapy, interpersonal therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, family therapy, if you're a kid, parenting training, ADHD coaching is now a huge new field that started teaching people to manage their ADHD symptoms. All of those are extremely effective ways of being able to manage this condition. Now, there are a lot of things that you can do as well, you know, from exercise to structure. But most importantly, if you're at that severe realm, you're probably going to have been driven to need to get help, and you want to start with the non-medication-type treatment first. I say if you go for a year and nothing works, then you consider medication at that point.
On the other end of the spectrum is people who are medicating their toddlers. What would you say to parents whose kids come home from preschool, let's say, or kindergarten or elementary school, and they're being encouraged to have their kids take medicine for ADHD?
I think it's horrific. And, you know, there's a recent study that just came out that showed that last year there were 10,000 2- to 3-year-olds that were being medicated for ADHD. And unfortunately, this is a case where the lower socioeconomic groups are much more represented, because the bulk of those diagnoses were on Medicaid individuals, of course, the low-income insurance. And I think it's sad, because obviously if you have the money and you have the resources, then you're probably more likely to look toward behavioral interventions or therapy, get an expert evaluation, And if you don't have the money, then you're a behavioral problem, then sadly medication becomes the first and in some cases the only option. I mean, if you're a single mom, working mom, and you've got two kids in school and one of them's a three-year-old and a severe behavioral problem, and you're struggling just to make ends meet to keep your family fed and don't have any other resources, then that becomes, wow, what else do I do? And so these kids are being medicated at 2 to 3 years of age, and I think it's a tragedy.
Do we have any data on what the effects are of early medication like that when these kids grow up?
We don't have any strong data yet, but there are some studies that are in the works. And it's not just looking at the young kids, but the one thing we know is that the brain is not fully mature and functional to around the early 20s, about 21 or so. So we also know that in terms of illegal drug use, that there tend to be more sequela, more long-term sequela, the earlier the individual starts using these drugs. So I think it would be safe to at least make an educated guess that, yeah, if there are long-term side effects from taking these meds, which we don't know that yet, then the earlier the child starts, the greater likelihood they will be worse. But the one thing that we do know is that the dopamine system in the brain, which is the pleasure reward center and also the focus concentration chemical in the brain, dopamine, is what's affected by the stimulant meds that treat ADHD. We also know that very same system is what's affected by cocaine, cane, and methamphetamine. Now, those long-term, we know the risks that go along with that use. The question now is, are we altering the pleasure reward center in the brain and making it much less sensitive to external pleasures because it's being stimulated by a chemical? And if that's the case, what does this ever come back to normal? Are we resetting the thermostat perhaps indefinitely? Now, again, that's speculation at this point, but there's some interesting studies that are looking at it, and I'll be very curious to see where that goes because I think it's a potential valid point.
Yeah, and then exacerbating class differences in our society if the low-income kids are the ones getting medicated and over-medicated. I mean, at the very least, you could maybe encourage parents to let their kids jump on the couch.
Yeah, and I think that it is it's not talked about much, if at all. Everyone talks about, oh, it's horrible, 2 and 3 year olds are being medicated. Yeah, it is. But if you look at the vast preponderance of those 2 and 3 year olds are come from low income families, then it is a form of class warfare, without a doubt. And no one's bringing that point up. But the problem is the poor don't have the resources to be able to go get the therapy. They don't have the money. They don't have the time to be able to get their kids in and try other alternatives besides the medication. And so, you know, we're looking at a system that we understand that the classroom system, the public classroom educational system, is broken with respect to the ADHD brain. It doesn't serve it at all. And you have to go outside it to a private educational system to be able to get the type of education that you need and deserve. And then that takes big bucks. So once again, I mean, the poor are left with very, very few and limited options in terms of what can we do for treatment. And a lot of times, you know, I feel sorry for the moms who throw their hands up and go, I don't want my baby on medicine, but I don't know what else I can do. I don't have any other options here.
Dr. Dale Archer is psychiatric medical director at the Lake Charles Memorial Hospital. His new book is called The ADHD Advantage. And not to end on such a kind of sad note, but I mean, for those mothers and fathers who don't have a lot of resources, are there any like super low-tech or easy things that they can do?
Yeah, I think to finish on a high note, I mean, first of all, I just want to emphasize that the name of the book is The ADHD Advantage, and I do list a dozen or more advantages in there of the ADHD brain. So that is extremely good news for anyone who is struggling with perhaps a child or themselves and a diagnosis. In terms of the low-tech methods, yeah, I mean, you know, it breaks down really into two different categories. Number one is at the school, and that's where, unfortunately, most of the problems are showing up, is at school. Unless you have an educational system that is willing to work with you, and, you know, some of the public school systems in America now have IEPs, independent educational programs, where they do take the child's learning ability into account and they do structure a curriculum that's going to work better for them. If you live in one of those areas, then that's fantastic. Many don't. And sadly, there's not a lot you can do if your child is stuck in a public school and it's very rigid and they say, this is how we teach, this is what you got to do. But when they get home, there are things you can do. And the one thing, as I've said before and I'll say it again, some type of exercise program for your child is imperative for the ADHD brain. And fortunately, that's one good thing, is that most schools still offer sporting activities for boys and girls to get involved in. And so I strongly encourage the parents to do that with their child. Number two, when you are responsible and can help them with homework, just some quick tips, exercise before homework, sometimes during homework, very short periods for each individual subject. So 15 minutes for math, then a break, then 15 of English, then 15 of reading, and then repeat if you need. But don't get on, okay, you have an hour and a half of math homework, and we're going to sit here and we're going to do it until it's done. That doesn't work well at all. So rotate those subjects. Allow the child to be able to get up and move around in between the brief burst of attention and get that exercise program going and utilize that. And I think those are some tips that help a vast majority of the kids that are out there.
Dr. Dale Archer, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.